Homeschooling is one way for parents to take a more direct role in their kids' education. It's not in the cards for everyone, but people who do it often say they can't imagine having their children learn any other way. You may or may not know that public schools have an increasingly large role in homeschooling. Mike Wilkinson is a reporter for Bridge Magazine. Bridge has just published a pair of investigative stories that go inside an increasingly intertwined relationship between some of the state's school districts and homeschoolers. Mike Wilkinson, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, the meat of the story is unpacking why some school districts are paying attention to and indeed even participating in a homeschool education for kids in their area. Why would they do that?
Well, many districts in the state of Michigan are hurting financially. Enrollment is going down, and in Michigan, it's one of 38 states where the state pays a district based on how many kids it has. It's not, you know, there's, you know, in some states, the local community will raise taxes, and it's independent of how many students. But in Michigan, all the property taxes go to the state, and for the most part, they send it back to the districts based on how many kids. So if you're a district of 100 kids and you lose two, you lose, you know,
it's X about, amount of dollars.
You lose about $16,000. So just demographically, the state has lost 6% of its school-age population in the last 15 years or so.
Because of birth rates going down and other factors.
We've gone up in age, and you know we're stagnant in terms of population. We're not growing as much. So that means these districts are losing population. And you can't cut your way to keep up a lot of times. You know, you've got a 1,000-student district. It loses 20 kids. Well, you could say that's a class. You can get rid of a teacher. Well, one left in 12th grade, one 11th grade, one, you know, on and on and on. So you really can't cut a classroom or a teacher or a school, but you've lost $160,000. So a lot of districts have turned to other avenues. They're using the school of choice program to kind of encourage students from other districts, which has created its own kind of competition. But what we found is that homeschool was another avenue that they've discovered that, you offering virtual classes and then these in-person private lessons that we talk about, and they're not all private, but they were able to then bill the state for the sewing or cooking or karate or ice skating class that these kids took. And so it meant more money for them. We do know from research that an online class is, you know, probably 25% cheaper. But in Michigan, what the state sends a district is not based on how much it costs. So if the kid is a homeschool student and he gets a dollar for his education, whether or not he's a brick and mortar student. So there's a big difference there in cost. And so there's the incentive is already baked in for them to kind of try to find these low cost alternatives to kind of boost their enrollment and their revenue.
Did you notice any pattern to the kind of schools that are reaching out to homeschoolers, whether in terms of geography or in terms of the demographics of the school?
Well, no. I mean, they're all over the state. You know, they're in the Upper Peninsula and the Western Upper Peninsula. They're in Traverse City. They're Kalamazoo, Southeast Michigan. It did not seem to be a pattern. I think all of them kind of acknowledged that there were some financial concerns. I mean, the Oxford schools, which, you know, we'll talk a little bit later about some of the problems. The Oxford schools in northern Oakland County have not gotten in any trouble from an auditor. They make no bones about it that they did this partially for financial reasons. 15% of their revenue and their students are in their virtual academy. And what they've done is they've turned around and said, okay, so no kid has to pay to be in the band. No one has to pay to play, you know, volleyball or football. We'll even supply, as they said, the bows and arrows for the kid in the archery club. Not every district can do that. And the reason they can do that is because they've gotten all this additional money. And they're able to kind of bank some of that because it's a lower cost than their traditional kids.
So, I mean, we can say that there's a financial incentive for some districts to offer these classes. It sounds like the revenue is not insubstantial.
Oh, no. I mean, it was over $29 million in the 2017-18 school year. It was $27 million last year.
$29 million across all the states, districts.
And for a district like Oxford, I mean, that, you know, you're talking about 15% of their revenue, and it amounts to over $4 million in new revenue. Again, there's a cost. I mean, they are spending some money, but they're able then to, as they said, pull off some of that profit and benefit their own kids. I mean, one of the criticisms is while Oxford and the Hamilton schools and Madison are doing it and taking this profit, it's not going to other districts. I mean, there's a lot of districts in the state that would love to have their kids not pay to play baseball or volleyball. They'd love to have more counselors or more, you know, mental health counselors that Oxford touts, but they can't. But these districts have found it, and they found a way to to help themselves out.
Well, is there, I mean, we talked about the fact that when kids leave a district, you can't necessarily cut your way out of the red. But is a zero-sum approach the way to look at the money that goes to the districts to support homeschoolers too? If that money weren't being paid into districts like Oxford, would it necessarily go to the other districts that are in financial need?
Well, it's coming out of the school aid budget and this, the fund. And if the money was there, if the $26-29 million was there, the $160 million that's going to the parochial schools, you know, there when the legislature was being asked to pay more per pupil, maybe it goes up $10, $20, $30, $40 per pupil, but it's not there because it is going to these other programs.
What kinds of classes are offered in this way? It sounded like the kind of things you mentioned, ice skating, sewing, tend to be electives?
It's absolutely all electives, and that's because the court decision in state law has kind of prohibited, you know, the state cannot spend public school dollars on a private school. They can spend it on a private student, but court decisions have narrowed that down to non-essential services and classes. So they can't offer English, they can't offer reading, you know, science. So they have to focus on these electives. And that's where some of the criticism comes. You know, the typical fifth grader, name that district, you know, might go to PE or gym class, an art class, or a music class once a week, but all combined, it's 1/6 of their year, right? And so if the state gives that district $8,000 for that kid, you could argue that a $1,300 is electives. In these programs where the kids are taking ice skating and karate and ballet, they're stacking them up as if they're taking 4/6 of a day, 2/3 of their day, 3/4 of their day is electives. And that's what the state said. Wait a minute, the regular kids aren't doing this. Why are we paying extra for these students? And because these are not, you know, it's not what we're doing everywhere else. And the traditional school, when it gets its money, that kid has to take assessment tests. They have to pay for administration. And these homeschool kids, they're not taking the M-STEP test. The district is not being judged by their performance on these electives. So people have been kind of critical of them.
You drilled down on a case study that we mentioned, the Oxford Public Schools in Oakland County. And just again, 15% of the kids who are on paper enrolled in the district are homeschool kids mm-hmm. who are participating in electives in this way. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what the district is like and what you heard from the superintendent about how it got like this?
Well, they started it, you know, a little less than a decade ago, and they were looking at, you know, in Oakland County, they were, you know, they're very quick to point out that they do not get the same amount of money as some of the other districts. Some of the other districts get more revenue because, you know, when the state completely revamped its funding system in 95, they got more, so they got it baked in that they get more. And their enrollment was flat. So they were looking for a way to raise revenue. So there's a number of districts that have worked with something called the Michigan Co-op EdTech Specialist, which is a consulting firm. And they were telling districts about this way to offer virtual education. And then it just morphed into and it got bigger. You know, so they've created this suite of classes where you kind of watch the class online. And then, you know, you go to the horse stables for a horse riding lesson every week, or you go to the music store and take a music lesson. And then it ends up being something that they're going to bill the state saying, hey, this kid did this.
Is there any oversight for what kind of instruction gets offered by public schools for homeschoolers?
Well, it does not appear so. Someone raised the question in one of the audits that, you know, these classes did not have the rigor of other classes. And the attorneys for the district said, rigor is not a standard, and it's not. You know, the state doesn't audit district classes and say, you know, basket weaving is not the equal of pottery. But you have these classes, and one thing that the Macomb Intermediate School District told me was when they drilled down and watched some of the online classes that were being offered to these students, it was the same class whether the kid was in third grade, second grade, or fifth grade. Their argument was the online class was kind of a shell. The real class was the weekly, you know, visit to
in-person, hands-on learning.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is a component. Is that necessarily a component of all these classes? Do they all have to have an in-person piece of it?
Well, I don't know if they all have them, but you know, there's a number of the districts, Traverse City, Niles, and Centerline were criticized heavily by the state for what they called private lessons. Now, Oxford has said they don't do private lessons; they're optional, and there's no fewer than 3 kids can ever go to the karate class or whatever, because as they told me, if one kid's sick, they don't want to ever be accused of it getting down to one kid, and they call them optional. Now, the Macomb folks say, you know, optionals, that's kind of a ruse. I mean, it really is a private lesson. When you look at some of the sheets that the kids have to fill out saying, hey, what did you do last week? To be part of a virtual, I got to back up here, because when you're a virtual class, you have to prove that you actually did the class. Much like in a traditional classroom, you have to attendance, was Johnny there the 5 days? So in the virtual setting, the school district has to prove to the state, if they want the money, that the kid actually was engaged. So at least twice a week, they have to have an email, some kind of contact with the student. So as part of some of the records that we got, you look at the emails and it says, you know, what did you do last week in the pottery class? And they never mention, oh, I learned about, you know, the masters of modern pottery. They always like, I made a candle holder. I made a cup. It was always about the hands-on thing. So is the hands-on in-person thing required? It seems that it's what the families were focused on. But like in Oxford said, they said it was optional. Interestingly, I did ask the principal of the Oxford school. I go, how would someone learn karate if they never took a karate class? And their reply was, well, they could watch all the videos, and then they could practice at home, and then they could take a video of themselves and then send it in for a grade.
And that's how it worked.
That's what she said would how it could work.
Since you've outlined all this, have there been any significant changes to the state laws that made it possible, or is anybody talking about changing it?
Well, I mean, there's a discussion to talk about, should virtual schools get the same amount of money? Look at the cost issue. There's no decision yet. You know, the governor currently wants us to look at cost. On the other end, in a way, saying, okay, some kids need more money. You know, they cost more to educate, and they're at-risk kids. They have needs that should be met. There's a counter argument as well. If we're going to go there, well, let's look at these virtual schools, and maybe, you know, since they don't have to pay for heat and cooling and on the building, there's not a janitor and the attendant things that go along with a traditional brick and mortar school.
Should they maybe get that much
should
money?
Should we get? So, yeah, you know, the there are some legislators who are looking at this now. Whether it goes into this level, we're not sure.
Has anyone done any serious research to look at how this is affecting outcomes?
Not necessarily outcomes, but finances. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan, which, you know, we collaborated with a little bit on the story, you know, they were looking at some of the similar, very similar issues, has been monitoring the increased use of shared time within the state. And they just came out with a report also yesterday, looking at just the growth in the population and the money going to homeschool kids and those kids that are in private schools. And there's a third element, and that is the number of districts that are adding a second year of kindergarten for children who are just barely too young to be in kindergarten. And it's all out from the same point of view. It's a way to add enrollment and get more money from the state.
You know, there are people who homeschool their kids because their children have special needs. You know, maybe they just learn differently, or maybe they actually have cognitive difference. And for some people, like, a traditional academic education wasn't really in the cards for their kid, and it might be okay with them. What has attention to the issue meant for the future of homeschooling programs?
Part of what you mentioned is one of the reasons these all started, right? So when the internet comes out and we have the ability to offer online programs, there were a lot of kids who dropped out of school who just didn't feel comfortable in the traditional setting, the brick and mortar setting. And this was a boon for them. I mean, this was a great thing to give them another opportunity. A lot of people who, you know, were able to come back and try to, you know, soldier on and get the diploma or the GED. So that is kind of the foundation of where these are, why we have a lot of these programs. You know, there's a lot of virtual schools in the state. What's happened is that model's been taken to offer something to this community. I don't know if it's going to affect ultimately whether it's offered. I mean, I know some are arguing that you can keep doing it. Let's just follow the rules. Let's not have five electives. Let's have one. The question becomes, would a district do it if the financial incentive is gone?
Mike Wilkinson is an investigative reporter with Bridge Magazine. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You can read his stories by following a link on our website.